I changed my title to a more general one. I give you a small introduction and then end up with some recent results. Baryonic structure in the cosmic web from absorption lines towards multiply imaged quasars or quasar pairs. That's historically actually the oldest application of gravitational lensing because it led to the identification of the first gravitational lens. And my collaborators are scattered all over the place, as are the telescopes where we obtained the data. Okay, so what is the cosmic web as far as baryons are concerned? And this is a purely gastronomical talk, the much maligned baryons. It is a web of filaments and sheets that are supposed to have been formed by gravitational instability. It is also probably the main reservoir of baryons at all times. It is a significant dumping ground for metals. And a lot of information has been obtained over the past 10-15 years about the Lyman Alpha Forest, but there's still a number of dark spots where you don't know anything. For example, how is the gas distributed spatially? This has never been really demonstrated. How does it move in the cosmic web? How does the gas get in larger nodes where the galaxies are situated? And what are the dominant physical processes that are shaping it? Is it just gravity? Do we see signs of AGN outflows or of galactic winds? And the standard approach is to take a spectrum of a single line of sight of the Lyman Alpha Forest, here redshift 3.5 quasar, and the sort of information that you get out of this is the baryon contents, can measure how many baryons there are, the metallicity, the temperature of the filaments, the ionization state, and most recently dark matter power spectrum, at least on small scales. And Peng Oh has already pointed out that there are some deficits here. The power spectrum is only one-dimensional. You cannot disentangle peculiar velocities and Hubble flow from just a line of sight information. And in order to get spatial and velocity information, we need to have at least a two-dimensional array of measurements. You get that by observing lensed quasars and closed quasar pairs. The setup is really easy. Imagine you have a lensed quasar, several images. Then the light path from each of these images goes through a slightly different part of the universe until it reaches you at the telescope. We take spectra of each image separately, and we find that differences in column density and in velocity can measure that as a function of the transfer separation between the beams, and then we get an idea of what the texture of the IGM is of any intervening galaxies, the density, and the velocity distribution. In reality, this is much more complicated. Each filament is composed of objects with a wide range of density. Here is an artist's representation. That's about 100 kiloparsecs proper. Redshift 3-ish, we have a number of galaxies here represented by regions of low ionization, silicon 2 gas, for example, or damp Lyman alpha systems. Further out, you find sometimes an accretion shock. Even further out, as the density goes down, carbon 4 becomes the dominant ion. And even further out, when you're approaching the mean density of the universe, this red line here, it is O6 that is most easily seen. There's a hypothetical phase of infalling primordial gas, never observed so far. We don't know if it's actually primordial or has any metallicity. There is an almost equally hypothetical phase of galactic winds that would be visible in collisionally ionized O6 or in shreds of ISM pulled out of the galaxy. Observational requirements to measure anything like that, such that if you want, for example, to investigate the scales of Lyman alpha clouds, you need to resolve about 500 kiloparsecs. That's a typical coherence length of redshift 3. Here it suffices to observe genuine quasar pairs. You can find pairs with that separation. If you want to do anything further, structure in galaxies or even in the vicinity of galaxies, carbon 4 systems, for example, you have to resolve about 1 kiloparsec proper, and that calls for lensed quasars. As a rule of thumb, quasar images with a separation of about 1 to 2 arcseconds with a typical redshift 3 quasar and the redshift 1/2 lens let you sample sub-kiloparsec scales in the Lyman alpha forest. Here's an example of three things that you can see. As you go closer to the quasar redshift, so the redshift of the lensed quasar, the beams converge, of course, and the magnification becomes formally infinite. And that's actually very nice if you want to study a very small structure, for example, in the ISM of a galaxy. Here's an example of a system that we hit towards Q1422. It's an absorption system visible in two images, the red and the blue line. And the nominal separation between lines of sight at that redshift is only 19 parsecs. Now, it turns out that this gas is extremely metal-rich, about solar, and has a density like the ISM of a normal galaxy. You can model the differences in column density and velocity by assuming this is an expanding bubble. Then it would have a radius of between 30 and 40 parsecs, an expansion velocity of maybe 100 kilometers per second or more. And that is just looks like an old supernova remnant. Of course, these things are very hard to see, and I've seen only one like this. More common are lower density systems. The lower the density, the more extended they are in the sky, obviously. This is a magnesium 2 system that has been seen towards the Einstein cross, 2237 plus or 305. You have three lines of sight, actually, you have four, but you could take spectra only of three of them. And there's the same magnesium 2 system in each of the images. It even seems to be expanding as you go up here. There's a two-component structure. It looks very much like an expanding wall of gas. And this is something that could easily be a galactic H1 shell, for example. It would look exactly the same. Now, if you want to do statistics, you need to get to a class of absorbers that are really common. And the really most common class of absorbers among the metal line systems is the carbon-4 absorbers. Carbon-4 is thought to be arising in a density regime that goes from about a few times the mean density of the universe to about 200, so right to the edge of the virial density. This is characteristic, so much we know from simulations of the immediate environment of galaxies up to about 100 kiloparsecs away, so of the main body of the filaments. You see that there are significant differences in carbon-4 as well, over that's about 1.7 kiloparsecs. We do not understand carbon-4 systems properly so far. That's why I give you only the phenomenological part. Here is a plot of the RMS velocity difference between the lines of sight, or structure function, as I would say, in turbulence, versus the transverse separation in kiloparsecs. This is proper kiloparsecs at the redshift when you measure this. There's the Lyman alpha forest proper, the low density systems with a density of 1 to 10. And there's carbon-4 systems, and you see something seems to be stirring carbon-4 systems. There's a distinct difference at any scale. There seems to be more vibrant than the average low density Lyman alpha forest. So that's an area where a lot of work can be done for theorists. We don't understand carbon-4 systems really. I think we do understand the Lyman alpha forest, the unsaturated Lyman alpha forest, low densities up to about 10 times the mean density of the universe. And I'll try to argue this point now. So about 2 years ago at another conference here, we started work on this, on the question, what are the systematic motions in the low density run-of-the-mill Lyman alpha forest? And of course, on a certain scale, Hubble expansion must be dominating this. You can ask the question, does the cosmic web follow the Hubble flow, or are there departures? In fact, this is not a trivial question, as you'll see. Can we see signs of gravitational collapse, and how does it happen? Are there traces of galactic feedback, outflows, for example, are they important? Are they messing up the Lyman alpha forest, as some people have been claiming the past few years, or are they negligible? And I'll try to demonstrate that the standard paradigm of the Lyman alpha forest is actually saying what its motions, and we'll check from observations whether that's correct. So here's an example of three quasar spectra. The spectra always occupy two panels. This is one spectrum here, the whole thing just goes on from the other side. Here's another one, here's yet another one. The first one is a lensed quasar, RXJ0911, can't read the rest. That's a former lensed quasar, Q2347, a famous one, and that's a quasar pair from SDSS. Now, the redshifts are different, the signal noises are different. I ask you to ignore that. Just look at the differences between the red spectrum and the black spectrum here in each panel. The separation here is 220 parsecs, the mean separation, of course, the beams converge. Here it's 60 kiloparsecs, and here it's 260 kiloparsecs. You see immediately at 220 parsecs, nothing is happening. They look absolutely identical, with the exception of very few points, and that's a very important point. Actually, I'll get back to this later. At 60 kiloparsecs, you still have a one-to-one correspondence between the clouds, so the filaments are being intersected, but the column densities are quite different. And the things are also wiggling. You can see this in some cases. They're wiggling in velocity a little bit. And at that separation, you're beginning to approach the coherence length of Lyman alpha clouds. You still see a lot of similarities. Voids are voids. Strong lines, are strong lines, and although they're a bit shifted, but things begin to fall apart here. We've tried to analyze this statistically just by measuring the velocity differences for each identifiable Lyman alpha line. And at small separations for the lens case, here 1.1 kiloparsec proper, the velocity differences are consistent with zero at average. The width of the distribution is given by the measurement error. It's a Gaussian here. But there are a few outliers, about 5 to 10%, that are statistically significant. So the velocity differences are much stronger than they should be. And I'll show you in a minute why that is. On large scales, 250 kiloparsecs, the velocity shear, the average width of the distribution, this is what I call shear here, has risen to about 30 kilometers per second. And the shape has become distinctly different. This is a sort of 1 over tangent alpha shape. The black line is a model, a simple slab of expanding, homologously expanding gas that intersects the lines of sight at a random angle. So if the Lyman alpha forest is approximated by something like this, you get a model that nicely reproduces the velocity differences. Of course, you can't measure anything from that because the model is too primitive. So you need a more realistic model. And what we did, this was happened here in November 2004, I think, on the conference. Matteo Wiel and I ran artificial lines of sinusoid pairs through his Lambda CDM simulation. It's a variant of the one that Springer created. And we wanted to see whether we can actually detect the three-dimensional velocity structure and derive it from the one-dimensional velocity shear that we see in real data. And here is here are two results. Here's again the 60 kiloparsec separation redshift 2 case and the 260 kiloparsec separation redshift 3.6 case. The solid histogram is the observed data, again, that we saw before. The dotted histogram is from a Lambda CDM simulation. I see it's an excellent fit, actually, within the statistical uncertainties. The solid line is, again, the expanding pancake model. And both the shape of the distribution and the width of the distribution is perfectly reproduced by the simulation. So it seems that as far as velocities are concerned, the general paradigm for the IGM in the context of CDM structure formation is correct. But how does the cosmic web actually move? We have not said anything about that. We just talked about projected velocities along line of sight. And if you have a simulation, you have the privilege to actually look at the density field and the peculiar velocities in your simulated box. So what we did then is we looked at the spectra. Let's say here's the Lyman alpha absorption line from one line of sight to the simulation box, and here's another one. And then we recreated the density clump that led to the absorption. And you subtract the peculiar velocity and compute the spatial centroid of the gas in the simulation that causes this line. Yeah, so this may be shifted this way, that here may be shifted that way. There's also Hubble expansion involved. And then when you found the centroid, you know there's something lying between the two lines of sight. You don't know about the exact shape here, but there's something continuous. Otherwise, you wouldn't get the absorption or similar absorption. So you draw a line between these points and measure the velocity along this line. And that is what you call your measurement of the expansion velocity of the cosmic web. So you can compare that to the velocity shear, which is just the projected velocity difference along the line of sight. So how does the universe expand? This is how it expands. Again, we have several redshifts here, redshift 3.8, 3.4, and redshift 2. Now the plots are the histogram of expansion velocities of Lyman alpha forest cloud pairs in the simulation. And the solid histogram is for absorption line selected cloud pair, absorption line selected measurements. And the dotted histogram is for random measurements. So you take random points in your simulation that are not necessarily outlined by absorption and measure the velocity between these two points. In the beginning, you see, first of all, that this is in units of the Hubble velocity, that the universe expands slightly faster than the Hubble velocity. That's not surprising because you're looking at a particular scale. This is true. The median expansion velocity is higher than the Hubble velocity at any redshift down to redshift 2. The mean is dropping below Hubble velocity at about redshift 2. You see that the distribution melts. It becomes broader and broader. There is a co-moving contraction here, and there's even proper contraction here further down. That's gravitational infall. The random lines of random measurements of between random test particles of the expansion look very similar at high redshifts, but they begin to separate out from the absorption line selected distribution and become much more pronounced and sharper at low redshift. And these regions expand faster and faster. And you can understand that when you take into account that a random measurement will end up in a void usually, you know, because you don't know where the line of absorption is. So voids are expanding faster and faster as you go to lower redshift, and that explains the observations. So very briefly, I would like to get back to these outliers that you saw in the beginning. In that particular quasar spectrum over a separation of less than a kiloparsec, there were 113 absorption lines, and about 10 of them, or maybe 8 if you leave out these slightly doubtful candidates with bad continuum possibly, seem to be shifted by a small amount. You see this here. And it's almost always a total, just a velocity shift and not a change in column density. So something, there may be some rotation or something else, some differential motion is happening, and the size of the motion is typically a few kilometers per second to maybe 20 kilometers per second. So what is that? Why do we see something over separations of a few hundred parsecs? It cannot be the Hubble flow because the Hubble constant is much too small. Do we see differential motion from galactic winds? Is this gas circling the train, maybe literally, or falling into a potential well? Now, this is actually work I've done past week here. In case somebody asked whether you're actually doing work here in this workshop, we do. And it's a little bit, actually, I can't do that, move it there. It's a little bit immature in that the plots are awful, and I have to firm up the conclusions a little bit. But essentially, the solid histogram here is again the distribution of velocity differences on very small scales, kiloparsec scales, from this gravitational lens of 9/11. And the distribution, if there were no intrinsic velocity differences, is given by this gray line here. It's just a Gaussian with a measurement error. And you see that here are the outliers. The solid counts that are here, up to here, roughly up to about 20-something kilometers per second. So 10%, maybe not quite 10% of the area. And we wanted to figure out whether that's actually winds, you remember, or gravitational infall. So Daisuke Kawata, who is a theory postdoc at Carnegie right now, has an SPH simulation of poor groups and individual galaxies that he can run with and without feedback. And he ran two realizations, one without feedback, one with ridiculously strong feedback and winds, to see whether there's any difference, whether winds can produce these turbulent velocities. And the answer is, it's very hard to see here, but I have another diagram that actually shows clearly that there's no difference between feedback and strong feedback as far as these lines over the separation is concerned. But we do get the outliers. And we get them in both simulations, a feedback simulation and a no feedback simulation. And that is actually proof that's independent of feedback, obviously, and that these motions must be caused by the gravitational potential itself. So how does this work? Here's the plot again. If you have a filament, again, here are some galaxies. I've drawn this by hand this morning, so forgive me, it doesn't look terribly good. And you have velocity vectors of the gas here. The gas is falling into the galaxies. The galaxies are moving in the filament itself. And if you look close enough to a potential well, you will see differential motions, maybe rotation, maybe something else, and sliding past and dropping into the potential well. And that seems to be the effect that's responsible for these outliers. So to some degree, it's the first time that we actually see gas motions in a filament. Okay, so these are the results, or the conclusions, so to speak, kinematics of the cosmic web. The observed distribution of velocity differences measured in lensed quasars and quasar pairs gives us a first glimpse of the large-scale structure velocity field. In the low-density IGM, it's consistent with a lambda CDM picture. It's actually consistent with any CDM picture. We don't have the resolution now. The noise is just too bad. But in principle, you can firm this up with any number of lensed quasars. The results are true for scales up to 260 kiloparsec proper. The simulations show that the overdense regions that are singled out by Lyman alpha absorption in the universe mostly expand with super Hubble velocities, and this can be understood. If you imagine that the filament is a bit like a piece of chewing gum, as you pull it apart, it gets thinner in the middle because the material drains to the nodes. The nodes are occupied by galaxies or galaxy clusters. And another way of seeing that is that filaments are actually the boundaries of voids, and since voids expand faster than the Hubble flow, these things have to expand faster as well. We've seen some clouds in the simulation in co-moving and proper contraction, and since we get identical one-dimensional velocity fields, I mean, this must be at work in reality as well. The random regions expand faster than Lyman alpha clouds, and ever faster as we go to lower and lower redshifts. And mostly the Lyman alpha forest is structureless on very small scales, proper kiloparsecs. In very few instances, maybe 5 to 10% of the lines, we see gas circling the drain of gravitational potential wells. Thank you.
Thank you. Time for a few questions. find extremely good agreement between between your models and your observation down to a few kilometers per second, and you're saying something about agreement to the lambda CDM model. If you can do this as function of redshift, if you have enough statistics, can you measure the cosmological parameters this way?
I don't think so. You cannot. This is not a way of measuring the Hubble constant to start with.
Not the Hubble constant.
Yeah. Okay. Look at the noise here. I have not ever looked at any other cosmological models. So if you would do a SCDM model or something else, who knows how this would look like? There would be a redshift difference, as you can see. The redshift look quite different. There's also a difference in the separation. This is 60 kiloparsec, and that's 260. Unfortunately, we could not select quasars at the same redshift because we have only a few lenses that are bright enough that can actually do this. But I'm a bit skeptical about doing cosmology with this because you need extremely high signal to noise. And I'd rather assume a cosmology and try to understand the infall of gas. So this is really galaxy formation rather than cosmology.
How bright do the quasars need to be for you to do this, and how many from this Sloan and all that efforts you think you can work with?
You need two images with about 90th magnitude in whatever band you're looking at, R band or V band. And that's possible actually, even with 6.5 meter in good seeing at least. And unfortunately, we've done most of the southern quasars, so we are eagerly awaiting quasar surveys. I'd be happy to hear about anything, any new efforts. But the Hamburg survey was a great source of quasars so far, but it doesn't exist anymore. So we hope that the Sloan will replace it partly. Unfortunately, the Sloan quasars are a little bit further equatorial, but it's doable from any telescope. So yeah, 19th magnitude, maybe 20th if you go for low resolution for some project.
Michael, you have mentioned the fact that you can explain the tail of your velocity difference just with gravitational motions, not super winds from galaxies. Can you reverse the argument and use your data to put some limit on how much galactic winds at this redshift can stir the Lyman Alpha forest?
Yeah, well, I can only say I don't see anything given the signal to noise. That's probably not a very strong statement. Now, the expectation that you and others have raised is that galactic winds only cover a small volume, a few percent at most. I mean, even if you make maximal assumptions, 100 kiloparsec bubbles or whatever. And it's about, that's a volume-weighted thing, if you want, a cross-section-weighted. So it's only a few percent of the total sample of Lyman Alpha Forest lines that would be affected by this. And with 100 lines per study, yeah, I can only throw up my hands. It is possible, actually, that...
It was 10%. Would you start to see that in the data?
If I look carefully, maybe. I think, actually, the clue to that is in the metal lines. So you'd have to look at metal lines, how turbulent they are. And carbon-4 system is an entirely open field. There's no real satisfactory explanation so far. So that's probably the place where I would try to model and see whether they can model carbon-4 systems with winds, or whether gravitational structure formations is really enough.